The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrade Inc. is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Yeah, NASDAQ, Scott, that's what we're going to be talking about. I'm John Fort. Here's what's ahead. Tech comes roaring back. Investors embracing the sector once again today as the NASDAQ soars. Is this a one-day blip or the return of the market darling? Plus, looking for an under-the-radar way to play the growing EV sector? How about buying into the one thing all of them need? Charging stations. We got the names to consider. And social media snapback. A look at why the sector is getting some love from Wall Street. But we begin with today's big rally. Dom?
It's the shopping list. It has been for, you could argue, the better part of a decade now at this point. Technology, specifically mega cap technology and consumer discretionary and some industrial type names are really trying to power this rally here. If you look at the Dow Jones Industrials, we're off the high of the session here, up about 290 points. We're pushing the 3,900 mark in the S&P 500, up 2%. And the NASDAQ, a key focus, back above that 13,000 mark. Remember, the intraday high yesterday was 13,001. We talked about that just a day ago on this show, up almost 4% at this point here. So again, a steep bounce back here for the NASDAQ composite. If you take a look at kind of what's moving, what's powering these transactions here, look at the equal weight S&P 500 ETF, ticker RSP, versus the S&P 500. You'll hear many traders and investors talking about this notion that there's a broadening of the market rally. It's not just the mega cap tech names that are powering things. These two ETFs show it. The orange line has been outperforming the white line for a while. But now, take a look at this. The outperformance is happening with the equal weight smaller companies within the S&P 500. That may be something healthy here. But speaking of those mega cap tech names, check out these ones on an intraday basis. Apple up 4%, Microsoft up 3%, Amazon up 4% and 2.5% gains for Alphabet, the parent company of Google. These companies make up over a third of the NASDAQ 100. That's how important they are. And then speaking of, talk about Tesla. That stock is having a huge day today, up about 15%, 16% now on the day. That brings its total decline since its record highs to down roughly 28%. Now, at the lows intraday, over the last week, we were down roughly 40%, John. So Tesla, keep an eye on that, as well as the big ETFs that hold it, including, of course, the ARK Innovation ETF, ticker ARKK. Back over to you, John.
I've not been able to take my eye off Tesla all year, Dom. Thanks. So is there more room to run in the bounce back for tech? Well, let's bring in Shi Chow, the financial advisor for UBS Global Wealth Management, and Phil Camparelli, a portfolio manager of global allocation at JP Morgan Asset Management. Guys, welcome. Shi, what do you think about what we're seeing happening in tech and how the individual investor strategizes around it going forward?
Well, thank you for having me here. I think the market in general is very emotional right now. A part of the reason is we're expecting a pretty strong post-pandemic economic recovery, but at the same time, we're worried about inflation. So you see these big swings in tech, and we certainly believe that tech is going to be the future, especially with this digital transformation that's going to stay permanently. So when we come out of this pandemic, I mean, we are going to see more importance in tech. So this is certainly a time to add into tech, but selectively, and also balance your portfolios.
Yeah, so Phil, what's the right weighting of tech? It doesn't have to be all or nothing, but tech has run so far, and some of the valuations, you know, even if tech is the future, these valuations are counting on it. So what's the right weighting?
Yeah, John, we should have saw this coming today. So today's March 9th, and crazy things happen on March 9th. It marked the day that stocks stopped falling in 2009. Last year, if you go back, oil prices dropped 25% on March 9th. So we should have bought a lot of volatility today because it's March 9th. So the answer to your question is we have about 9% of our fund in a growth manager. Now, that's really not very much change from last year. The difference, though, is that we've allocated more to value. Now, John, these are great companies. These are companies that are meeting earnings. They're beating earnings, and that's going to continue to happen. But you have to make room in your portfolio for what we're considering a very high-class problem, which is folks really getting their portfolios in order and making sure that they have enough value as things get better. And this powerful dynamic of fiscal stimulus plus an extraordinary vaccine rollout so far to date, right? And the third thing being a consumer whose savings rate is double long-term averages. That is going to be a really nice tailwind for value stocks. But don't ditch the growth stuff. Just make room for value away from passive investing into active managers that can navigate the reopening trade.
Now, there's the advice about picking individual stocks and not going too deep into indices. And you know, for the individual investor with only so much money to spread around, that can be tough. So I know that you're looking at global small caps, emerging markets. Anywhere in particular you can call out?
Yes, we really like global small caps, emerging markets. That's going to benefit from, you know, higher yields, even inflation, and particularly China. I mean, China everybody has been pouring a lot of money into the U.S. markets, and that's great. China is also the second largest economy in the world, and we are expecting about 8% GDP growth this year. So it's just a market that investors can't miss. So especially with tech, maybe looking into some of the names in Chinese companies as well.
Phil, how do you position emerging markets, which can be really risky, some of which have been hit hard by COVID and won't recover as quickly as more developed markets in a portfolio?
Yeah, so emerging markets for us was a pretty high confidence view coming into this year. I think one of the things that changes that, and China was mentioned, and we believe in that. I mean, we created a China A-share strategy in our fund for the first time in history. However, China is dominated by a lot of the same themes that we're seeing here in the U.S. You know, Tencent and Alibaba are like the FANG stocks of the U.S. So as interest rates pick up, that will put pressure on some of those growthier type names. But again, John, this is a really high-class problem. We're talking about a global recovery this year that EM should enjoy. It's not the only thing that could really hurt that would be if this was just a U.S. recovery. But this wasn't just a U.S. pandemic. This was a global pandemic. And financial conditions, John, I just want to be really clear here, because a lot of people are saying, oh, my goodness, rates have gone up by 60 basis points in 6 weeks. Financial conditions are only getting to the point that it was at their easiest place in the last cycle. And financial conditions drove a lot of asset price returns last year. So emerging markets still belong in the portfolio. Financial conditions are still an extremely accommodative place. But I would say that U.S. value and U.S. small cap, John, are probably our two biggest views in the very near term.
All right. Lots of good views there from both of you, Xu Chao and Phil Camporelli. And if you are looking beyond tech stocks, head to cnbc.com/pro for 5 retail names that could be winners with stimulus checks set to go out this month. Now let's turn to financials, where the old is meeting the new. SoFi announcing today that it's acquiring a bank in an effort to become a full-scale bank itself. The acquisition is going to open up a large number of new opportunities for the fintech company, it hopes. Kate Rooney joins us now with more. Kate.
Hey, John. The deal puts SoFi on a fast track to expand its banking business. The fintech company plans to buy Golden Pacific Bancorp. That's a small community lender in California for about $22 million. This is all part of SoFi's plan to bring banking services in-house. So instead of using a third party, they want to be the ones holding customer deposits and issuing loans. SoFi had already applied for a national bank charter, but now instead of applying to be a brand new bank, it will apply to be a bank holding company. A few reasons to do this. For one, it's a lot cheaper. CEO Anthony Noto telling CNBC this morning that the move could save them as much as $300 million. And SoFi is not the only fintech company looking to cut costs. Lending Club was really the trailblazer here, buying Radius Bank last year. Vero Money was approved for its own charter, and Squares Bank officially launched last week. If the trend continues, though, analysts tell me that it could be bad news for those small community banks that have been handling the customer deposits for fintechs so far. And remember, SoFi announced in January it was merging with a SPAC run by Chamath Palihapitiya. That deal is expected to close in a couple weeks, but take a look at shares of that blank check company today. It's been up as much as 16% today. John, back to you.
Kate, we were talking to Anthony Noto this morning about this move, and I was trying to figure out whether this sort of U.S. version of the Challenger Bank boom has some danger in it. And he seemed to imply that with this move, if they become a bank, they're going to be able to offer interest rates much higher than typical, that they won't be as locked into the mode that banks typically are. And I mean, that's a risk for them, right? Because they're giving money away at a higher level, kind of as a marketing thing. Is there kind of a proven track record for that kind of model?
It's been interesting. It puts them closer to the regulators, so it cuts out a middleman, and they have direct contact with the regulators now. So in that sense, it's a risk. The onus is on them. If anything goes wrong, this is now SoFi's problem versus a small community bank. But as far as the interest rate, that has really been how fintechs have been competing. It's how they get people in. They offer a higher interest rate, and often they lower that rate, which SoFi has done, Wealthfront has done. So as interest rates have gone down, they've been forced to sort of dial that back. But that has been the way that people and fintechs have been competing in this market. Who can offer the most money in return on your deposits? So we'll see if they're able to do that. It could also be a good customer acquisition channel.
Yeah. It seems like he was saying they're willing to go even higher than they have in the past, though, because I was talking about, 2.5% used to sound really great, but now it's, pennies. All right.
Right. There is a cap. But they, yes, absolutely. They'll have to subsidize it a little bit. So it sounds like they're spending money to make money.
Well, we all want yield, so we'll see. Kate, thank you. Now coming up, the massive growth in tech throughout the pandemic has created an unexpected winner in the real estate world, data centers. We've got the story and the name set to benefit next. And a number of the FANG names jumping today, but still got a long way to go before getting back to the highs. Apple's still down about 16%. From its 52-week high, the biggest drop off the group. Amazon off by nearly 14% from its 52-week high, and Netflix still off by a little more than 14%. We'll be right back.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange. One sector we don't always associate with tech is real estate, but the rise in remote working, cloud services, and streaming this past year have given a boost to the data center market. Diana Olick joins us with more. Diana.
Yeah, John, we're coming to you from the cooling center of one of the hottest sectors in real estate, that is data centers. This is a Line data center in Ashburn, Virginia, which increased its credit facility by more than $1 billion last year for more expansion, of course, due to more demand. Now, Northern Virginia is the largest data center market in the world and is in the midst of a massive construction boom, accounting for more than 60% of the current pipeline in the United States. This area is now data center central. As the different companies build in clusters in order to share information closely, data centers were actually the highest performing REIT sector last year, ending up 21%. Major names include CoreSite Realty, CyrusOne, Digital Realty, Equinix, and QTS Realty Trust. Now, demand for data centers fell back about 11% last year to the second best year on record as companies froze their IT budgets due to COVID. That according to a new report from CBRE. But data usage grew due to COVID and everything that went online.
We do believe that 2021 might be the record year, and then we'll accelerate thereafter, not only in markets that are heavily concentrated like Northern Virginia, but also spreading into some of these smaller markets for resiliency, cheaper power, green, and edge.
Now, one of the problems, though, the only thing standing in the way, it seems right now, is higher interest rates, because, of course, the cost of capital is so important to growth companies like this one. That's what's making some volatility in the stocks of all tech sector stocks, as well as the data center stocks. John?
Love those data center shots and the insight, Diana. Thanks. Now, despite the strong 2020 growth, my next guest notes that data center equities have underperformed noticeably over the last few months. Along with the tech trade, they also seem to be losing steam in the reopening rotation. Let's bring in Nick Del Deo, the senior analyst at MoffittNathanson. Nick, I also wonder about supply issues here, because it would seem that, in a sense, these data centers are competing against the megascale cloud. Do you end up with a situation eventually, kind of like the semiconductor market, where if there's a big fab build out, eventually it affects the pricing?
Well, you know, the answer is it depends. It depends on the niche, and it depends on the players, right? So broadly speaking, you know, the data center market can be bifurcated into two pieces. You've got network-dense, interconnection-oriented operators on lines of Equinix or CoreSite or parts of Digital Realty's business. And they have folks who cater to some of the larger-scale deployments that the hyperscalers need to put out there, like CyrusOne, parts of Digital Realty's business, or QTS. When the hyperscalers build their own facilities, like Google built its own data center, or Facebook or what have you, that can certainly substitute for leasing activity that would otherwise go to some of the public players. But again, it tends to be focused in that part of the market as opposed to the interconnection-oriented area.
How deep do you dig and look at exactly where these companies are building out their facilities? Because costs are going to be different depending on how much they have to pay for power, how great the network connectivity is in that geography. I mean, I guess there's a reason why Virginia is such a popular spot.
Yeah, Northern Virginia is the largest data center market in the world for a variety of reasons. Land is inexpensive and plentiful. There's a ton of connectivity. Power is cheap. Natural disaster risk is low. There's a workforce that's trained to promote these assets. The tax environment is favorable. So, you know, those things tend to tends to snowball. So, you know, when people tend to go big in an area, it tends to attract more more construction. And Northern Virginia is sort of the prototypical example of that.
So what determines which of these stocks, you know, CoreSite, Equinix, CyrusOne, Digital Realty, QTS, et cetera, over the long term get the benefit of the doubt on valuation? What are the performance metrics and factors that investors should think about?
I prefer to look at return on invested capital. Again, these are very capital-intensive businesses, so it's very important to understand the ability of the businesses to translate the significant growth that they're seeing into value, and specifically value per share. If you look at, you know, call it an Equinix or a CoreSite that operate with these interconnection-oriented, network-dense assets, those facilities are hard to replicate. So they get a measure of pricing power and premium returns that other players in this space can't achieve. And I think as a result, they tend to convert growth into value at a higher cadence and warrant higher multiples. You know, in contrast, when you look at most other players, it's a little more challenging for them to convert that growth into value. So in terms of our preferences, we prefer Equinix and CoreSite.
All right. Nick Del Deo, that's a great way for investors to sift through and figure out what they should do. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And now coming up, one thing that all electric vehicles are probably going to need: charging stations. Ahead, we've got two names that are taking the charge in that sector. Should be on your radar. And taking a look at shares of Stitch Fix, sinking today following results. The company saying it had one of the strongest Januaries ever and saw quite a large amount of client additions, but big shipping delays created problems that hit revenue. Stock off more than 50% from its high. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So
brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, 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 click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's get a check on the markets on a big rally day. The NASDAQ dominating gains. You can see it there, up 4%. The S&P up 2%. The Dow almost 1%. Now let's check the sectors. Consumer discretionary, tech, of course, healthcare and utilities are your winners. Energy, the only sector lower. Now let's focus in on the tech trade. The FANG stocks roaring back today. All five names jumping, with Apple the leader, up, let's see, more than 4%, as is Amazon. Semis also on the move. The ETF, SMH, up nearly 6%. NVIDIA, Broadcom, Lam Research, and Applied Materials leading that group. Cybersecurity stocks all in the green. CrowdStrike, CyberArk, FireEye, your winners. One area that's not participating in the rally, the media names. Discovery, Viacom, Fox, among the worst S&P performers, though I will say Comcast still doing okay. That's our parent company. Now to Rahel Solomon for a CNBC News update. Rahel.
Hi, John. Hello, everyone. The Pentagon is set to extend National Guard protection of Capitol Hill for another 2 months. Capitol Police had requested assistance to continue for more than 2,000 National Guard members. The National Guard deployment at the Capitol is set to end on Friday. Nearly one in three women worldwide experience physical or sexual violence. That's according to a major new study by the World Health Organization. Researchers found that much of the violence started early, with a quarter of women experiencing violence by an intimate partner by the time they reach their mid-20s. And children's author Norton Jester has died. He wrote the 1961 classic The Phantom Toll Booth and 11 other books. Norton Jester was 91. And that is our CNBC News update for this hour. John, I'll send it back to you.
Rahel, thank you. And now the so-called Reddit stocks continuing their volatile run. GameStop looking to climb back to those highs. Well, maybe more than 400. And a new name is catching Reddit investors' eyes. Josh Lipton joins us with more on that. Josh, what is it?
So, John, as of this morning, of the current top 100 posts on that Wall Street Bets Reddit forum, the most frequently mentioned stocks include GameStop, AMC, and Palantir. All those names seeing gains today. They have also been three of the most frequently mentioned over the past week. Remember, GameStop coming off a monster day yesterday. That's when the company announced that former Chewy executive Ryan Cohen is going to lead a committee to shape GameStop's transition to e-commerce. Tesla surging higher today, too. Another popular mention on that forum. Tesla tracking here for its best day since March of last year, potentially getting ready here to snap a five-day losing streak. And one interesting name that also caught the attention of Reddit traders today, Apple, moving sharply higher in today's trade. Now, it has been under pressure, about 15% off its all-time high. Of course, that's after a remarkable 2020 in which it surged 80%. This morning, the team at Loop Capital telling their clients they believe Apple is planning a virtual event on March 23rd in which the company, they say, could introduce products like AirTags, new iPad, and next-generation AirPods. John, back to you.
Now, Josh, anybody can look at Reddit and Wall Street Bets, even if you're not an individual investor, little guy. You could even be a hedge fund manager and look at this. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean, right, that this is all powered by the little guys.
No, of course not. The fuel could be coming from a lot of different sources. I would mention just one other name, though, that's kind of interesting. Some changing flavors and tastes here, John, in terms of what they're looking at. Rocket was not even in the top 30 this morning. Now, you remember, that's one we've been mentioning a lot because it was in the top 5 last week, and that one has been on this just wild ride. Last week, it was up 70% in one day, though about 40% now off its all-time high there, John.
Wow. All right. We'll see how long these ideas stick. Josh Lipton, thank you. Now, on this big rally day, FANG has got some bite. Tesla pulls a U-turn and Bitcoin is back above a key level. All that and more coming up in Rapid Fire. Now, let's get a quick check. Here's what's on the Dow 30 heat map. Intel and Apple, the best performers. Amex and Disney are the biggest laggards. And as we head to break, March is Women's History Month, and we're spotlighting some of our CNBC contributors. Here is Pivotal Advisor CEO Tiffany McGee on Breaking Barriers.
I heard from a father that said every day at lunchtime, he watches Halftime Report with his six-year-old little girl. And one time when I was on, she points to the screen and she says, "Daddy, she looks like me." And so when I was her age, I didn't have women investors to look up to. So it warms my heart that little girls now can watch our show and see women like me and Courtney and Shannon and Liz. I think it's important for us to think about little girls and understand that they need to know what's possible.
Now let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar. It is time for Rapid Fire. Here with their takes are Dominic Chu, Julia Boorstin, and Nilay Patel, editor-in-chief at The Verge and a CNBC contributor. Well, first topic, we're calling an audible. We were going to talk about Fang. That's gone. Disney just saying that Disney Plus has topped 100 million global paid subscribers. That's up more than 5% over just a month. Julia, does this mean that Disney's velocity is something that even Netflix might have to worry about?
Well, look, I think one thing's for sure, John. This announcement of 100 million plus subscribers for Disney Plus is a sign that the audience for Disney Plus is so much bigger than the company originally anticipated. I just have to remind you of the company's original forecast. They said they aimed to have between 60 million and 90 million subscribers by 2024. Then in December, they upped those forecasts. Now they're saying they want between 230 million and 260 million subscribers by 2024. But the fact that they have already 16 months into the launch of this service far exceeded their original guidance just means that this is not just a service for families. And they talked about that in their most recent analyst day, not just a service for family and for families and for kids, but really a service that can have really broad appeal.
Yeah, I really liked Raya and the Last Dragon, though I know it didn't do that well or hasn't yet. Nilay, when you look at Disney's strategy and the content library, how much of that do you think plays into this, and what does it kind of signal for the rest of the more traditional media names out there, the Comcast, the Viacoms of the world?
I think we live in a franchise world. First, Julie, I want to say I think Disney sandbagged that initial estimate a little bit. I think they set themselves up for success. If you've got Marvel and Star Wars, you don't think you can get to this number fast. I think you're probably undercutting yourself. But I think we live in a franchise world, and Disney's ability to execute on the Marvel franchise, on the Star Wars franchise, is second to none. The challenge for them is they are undergoing their leadership transition, right? This was Iger's last call. Bob Chapek is the new CEO. Iger's going to slide over into that executive chairman role. Chapek's got to execute on reopening theme parks. He's got to execute on live theaters coming back. Those theater owners are going to want some of these movies. There's a lot here for them to continue to execute on. The thing they have is franchises people love. Yeah. And a creative ability that brings the audience week for week for shows like WandaVision.
Dom, I got to think Chapek lucked out. I mean, the theme park guy before the pandemic gets the top job, and the streaming guy, Kevin Mayer, kind of goes out the door, and look at these numbers, right?
It's pretty amazing because what Nilay talked about was struck a note with me, because I am not a Disney Plus subscriber. Because I am a Marvel Cinematic Universe fan, even though I'm a massive MCU Marvel fan, I'm a massive Star Wars fan, I likely wouldn't have gotten into buying for it if it wasn't for two small children at home. So even though I'm
sure,
a huge fan,
man,
I probably wouldn't have done it. The audience growth here is, yes, driven by the fact that I paid the bills, but also because my kids, specifically my four-year-old daughter, spends way more time on the platform than I do. So if you take a look at the way that streaming has developed, it wasn't that long ago that I remember reporting on streaming video and having it be synonymous with Netflix. It almost feels like these days, when you talk about streaming video, it's synonymous with Disney Plus for a reason. And a lot of that has to do with the franchises, and that's going to be huge.
But Dom, and I just want to point out here that, you know, Disney is committed to making 100 new titles this year. What that means is that everyone is going to be spending more on content. Not that it's just Netflix paying a fortune for new content. Disney's investment in 100 titles, just think about what that means, the types of different franchise titles we're going to see. It means that everyone is going to be spending more. And in a way, it raises the bar for all of these new streaming players. And we just got Paramount Plus just a few weeks ago.
Dom,
by the way, Julie, let me say this. I was a massive fan of WandaVision, and I cannot wait to see what they do now that they have the Fox properties, to see the X-Men, you know, wrapped in, and Deadpool wrapped in, and everything else. This could be huge for comic book fans everywhere.
That's right, Dom. Don't give me that. It's my four-year-old's fault. You know you're down for some Book of Boba Fett and some Falcon and Winter Soldier. Anyway, all right, topic two. Social media stocks also rebounding today. Shares of Pinterest, Twitter, Snap, and Facebook all moving higher. But month to date, they're still seeing declines of double digits, with Facebook barely holding on to a gain of about 3%. Neil, I mean, some of these names are stressed. We've had that move in the 10-year yield and all of that. I don't know what to make of this, except Pinterest sure has been an interesting company to watch over the past couple quarters.
You know, I think that the simple answer here is that they are competing and building new revenue lines, and there's promise in these new revenue lines. It's not just, can we peel off some digital advertising share from Facebook and Google? I just had Twitter's had a product, Kayvon Bakeport, on my podcast Decoder that's out today, and he's talking about super follows, letting creators monetize their social graph on Twitter. He's talking about invite-only spaces that look like Clubhouse. They're building out an ecosystem of revenue opportunities for people on Twitter that looks exciting and doesn't look like Facebook's business. I think the same is also true for Snap. The same is true for Pinterest. That is a segment that has been pretty static in terms of revenue opportunity. And now I think you're seeing a lot of excitement about what could be there in addition to advertising.
Twitter's just got to do it, though, Dom. I mean, they talk about these product moves, and sometimes it seems like they talk about them so much before they do them.
I think, yes, you have a great point here. The whole idea of having some optimism about these is the ability to monetize the content. And we just talked about content during the last segment there with regard to Disney Plus. If you are going to gear your business model towards content creation and the monetization of that content, then you have a real runway here. What's curious to me is that Facebook has not yet really participated in this, only because when I think of content creators through this point in the social media cycle, I think of mostly Instagram, right? I think about the product there, how much the influencers can make, how much product they put out there, how they can get me to transact on the platform. If you are a social media company that's looking to kind of do something along those lines, maybe it still is Facebook and Instagram that are the model for you. I don't know if Twitter and Snapchat are going to be able to catch that kind of a situation like what Facebook and Instagram are doing.
Well, Julia, you just talked to Evan Spiegel a couple weeks ago. That stock's been on a tear, and he has held to his built here, designed here strategy.
Absolutely. And look, I was just talking to some analysts this morning about the fact that these stocks are moving higher. And they said, look, we love to hear that Snap is expecting to have 50% revenue growth for the next several years. They don't anticipate that growth to slow. And the other thing I'm hearing a lot about, and we just heard Fox's CFO talk about that this morning at the Deutsche Bank conference, is the idea that the advertising market is coming back. That's going to benefit both the traditional media players, and social media is going to figure out how to tap in to that growing ad revenue.
Yeah. Well, you got to get people to spend that money. Topic three, Tesla making a pretty big U-turn today. Shares are up 20%, on pace to break their longest daily losing streak since last March, though they're still down about 23% from their all-time high. The stock's also getting an upgrade to buy today from New Street with a price target of $900 a share. That's about 40% higher from here, right on par with its record high in January. Dom, I don't know whether to pay any attention at all to all the various moves in Tesla because, I mean, it's got more torque than a Tesla.
Or even the analyst commentary, because it's all over the board at this point. I mean, there was a consensus trade as it was going up that if you're an analyst, you had to upgrade this. You had to put the price targets higher on this because it was just the momentum of the overall move in Tesla shares. Right now, there's actually a huge focus on whether or not the Tesla pullback is one that you really want to buy. Today's move suggests perhaps yes, or it may just be short covering. However, if you look at the way that it plays out, the entire thesis, or a good amount of it over the course of this next several years, will be about that TAM, right? The total addressable market for electric vehicles. And a lot of the analysts' bullishness about it is because Tesla has such a huge kind of position. They are entrenched. They have the premium end of the market really well set. And that's the reason why you're bullish on the stock. But this is one of those names that you have to really figure out whether or not it's the charts that dictate the action or whether the fundamentals are the ones that are really pushing things, John.
Well, Julia, I don't see how this can even be justified if you're looking at the total addressable market in vehicles. You got to be looking at software, platforms, battery technology.
And don't forget about all the charging stations, John. I mean, there are so many pieces of the ecosystem. We've been talking about ChargePoint and these other charging stations that are going to really need to roll out broadly and be available throughout cities before this can really become a mainstream thing.
Neil, has any other car brand or, EV brand even approached Tesla just in marketing raw strength?
I don't know about marketing. I will tell you that I have a bright blue Mustang Mach-E review unit in my driveway right now. It is a great car. It is fantastic. Dealers, Ford dealers, are already putting $10,000 markups on that car. They're moving. Their challenge, like Julia said, is the charging infrastructure. It is the thing that will hold that car back from being as competitive with the Tesla Model 3 as I think Ford wants it to be and people want it to be. If they can accelerate that, this is going to be a great year for EVs. This is a great year for that total addressable market. You've got the Volkswagen ID4, you've got the Mustang, you've got Ford's electric F-150, you've got the Cybertruck. There's more coming, and I think this market is going to hit a maturation point that is really exciting.
Huh? A head turner. Okay. Now, finally, Bitcoin back above that $1 trillion market value for the first time since February. Investors have pointed to increased participation from institutional investors as a factor for keeping the price afloat. And just this week, Chinese app maker Meitu said it has purchased not only Bitcoin, but also Ethereum. Julia, it seems like the high price of some of these cryptos has become the justification for the high price. And the fact that the institutions are getting in, it's an idea that it's going to keep these things high, but I don't know. Institutions are in the stock market all the time, and it crashes.
Well, look, what you just described is a very circular argument, John, but I do think to have the move of companies like PayPal get into Bitcoin, get into these cryptocurrencies, does mean that there is an opportunity for them to be part of our everyday lives, things that we actually use instead of just investing in them. So I think it'll be interesting to see how those big corporate moves into crypto really impact their usage, not just the trading of them.
Nilay, does this Bitcoin thing become kind of like Tesla, supported by the cultural moment even more than the blockchain and technical foundations?
I only ever say one thing about Bitcoin, which is, for all I can tell, people are interested in Bitcoin because they like dollars. So they're buying Bitcoin because they see the dollar number go up. The real question is, when are people going to spend their Bitcoin and use it as a currency? Because that is the thing that will make it actually compete with the dollar.
Dom, I thought they like Bitcoin because they're interested in Elon Musk.
I think they like Bitcoin just because they see the price go up, like Neil just said. I mean, but the use case is one that I've been talking about for a while. And one of the things that really got my attention is, over the last couple of weeks, during one of my takeout runs to go get food for my family for dinner one night, I went to a Japanese restaurant near me, and for the first time I noticed they are accepting Bitcoin as payment. So you can actually go there, transfer your kind of Bitcoin, pay for my sushi dinner or whatever it is. Now, that's going to be a huge development. Right now, we're talking about supply, demand, Bitcoin, fixed supply. How much is it really worth? Fundamental this and fundamental that. But if you really are going to get people to start transacting in it, that's when you could really start to see a real pickup in this. And by the way, if you're an investor on the institutional level, John, I'm not sure you like the volatility. This All thing right. has to smooth out, and maybe then you get more people really interested.
Got to point out, I mean, sushi, Disney Plus, Dom, you just do everything for the family. Love it. That warms the heart. Guys, that was great. All right, still ahead, EV charging names, ChargePoint and Blink getting drained so far this year. ChargePoint down 31%, but Cohen says it's time to buy and that the electrification of mobility has only just begun. The analyst behind that call joins me next. And be sure to tune into CNBC's On the Edge tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern for sharp opinions, the hottest takes, and fierce debates on some of the biggest stories in the business world. And The Exchange will be right back. EV trade rebounding today. Along with Tesla, you have NIO, Nikola, Li Auto, and Lordstown jumping. If you want to play the sector, why not buy the part of the market that all the EV cards are going to need? Charging stations. Cowen just initiated coverage in the sector with a positive bias, with two names they say are poised for a rally. Joining me now with some picks is Gabe Dowd, the senior energy analyst at Cowen. Gabe, how do you pick? Tell the difference between these stocks.
Yeah, John, thanks for having me. And, you know, I think to your point, your conversation with Dom, I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of new, exciting EV models set to hit the market over the next couple of years. And, you know, the one thing that had prohibited EV adoption or wider scale EV adoption to this point is really charging infrastructure. And we do think that proliferates over the next 10 years at about a 30% CAGR. We do see 2030, likely you'll need about 2 to 3 million public connectors, and there's likely to be another 5 million connectors deployed at home. So we do see overall significant growth ahead over the next decade in the market. And between the two stocks, we're coming out positive on ChargePoint and Blink. Two different business models. We do like ChargePoint as our top pick. They've really differentiated themselves up to this point as a market leader in the U.S. with about 60 to 70% hardware share. And the company does not monetize the driver, which essentially means they don't sell electricity to the driver, as you know, kind of use an analogy to a typical gas station selling gasoline to customers refueling their traditional car. So ChargePoint makes a hardware sale, and then also attached to it is their software offering, which provides some nice sticky revenue that comes at higher margin. So we do think the company, like I said, although it's a nascent sector thus far, they've done a really nice job of taking share. And we do
now,
expect
if you believe, though, if you believe that a bunch of Teslas and maybe these Mustangs and other cars are going to sell, then shouldn't you want to play with somebody who is making money off of that customer sale?
Yeah, John, that's a good point. And so that's why we do like Blink here. We think the company is attractively positioned to capitalize on increase in utilization on charging infrastructure. You know, today, I think most estimates put it, or our estimates put it, around 5 to 10% utilization, which likely means 1 to 2 charging sessions per day. As the growing EV fleet continues, utilization is likely to spike higher. And we do think Blink is well positioned, and they do have significant operating leverage in the business model. So it's two different business models at this point. It's an early sector, as you mentioned. It certainly remains to be seen which one will be best positioned, but we do like both for those specific reasons.
How much of this is real estate connected, or kind of like the cell tower business, where you question how good are certain companies at knowing where to place these things and acquiring that location at a reasonable cost?
Yeah, John, it's a great question. You know, it's certainly a land and expand model, right? So I think relationships with your site host, where your site partners comes into play. A lot of these companies do a lot of deep dive work on where to exactly put a charging station. You know, for some of the slower stations, you'll see them proliferate in supermarkets, you know, Whole Foods, Walmart, Costco. And really, the utilization on that is really about changing consumer behavior. You're not necessarily going to fuel anymore, but recharging your car will ultimately become part of your background of your day-to-day scenario. Maybe you hit the gym, you know, you charge your car while you're at the gym.
Okay. Well, I can see that possibility. Players like Costco, you think still going to be important here like they are with gas? Quickly?
Yeah, sure. Look, Costco, obviously part of their model is offering cheap gasoline. We think ultimately they could offer cheap electricity at a particularly or extremely low price to capture more foot traffic.
That would be an interesting benefit with the membership. Gabe Dowd with Cowen, thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Now still ahead, 1 million more women than men have reportedly lost employment during the pandemic. But new data from CNBC and SurveyMonkey showed that not all is lost. The discouraging new numbers about women's ambition are next. And don't forget, you can watch us live on the go using the CNBC app. The Exchange will be right back. The pandemic has hit women's employment particularly hard, and now it's hitting the way they describe their ambition as well, according to the new CNBC SurveyMonkey Women at Work survey. Julia Boorstin is back with those findings. Julia.
John, that's right. 1 year into the pandemic, we have seen a big decline in ambition, which could have meaningful ripple effects across the economy and could exacerbate existing gender gaps. Our new CNBC SurveyMonkey Women at Work survey found that 2%, 42% of women describe themselves as very ambitious. That 42% is down from 54% in our survey before the pandemic. For women of color, the declines are particularly large. The percent of Black women who said they were very ambitious fell from 75% last year to 54% this year, while Hispanic women saw the biggest percentage point drop from 65% to 42%. Now, this all comes as 65% of women we surveyed say that the pandemic has made things worse for women in the workplace. 22% say their career has had a setback, and 37% say they've considered quitting their job. Now, we have seen these trends play out in women's participation in the workforce, which hit a 33-year low in January. Over the past year, more than 2.3 million women left the labor force compared to roughly 1.8 million men. That's according to the National Women's Law Center analysis of the latest jobs report. You can find much more from our exclusive survey online at cnbc.com/makeit. And we will bring more to you later today on CNBC. John?
Julia, sentiment is a curious word, and it seems to me that there might be a difference between what women want and what they feel that they can be prepared to put in right now in order to get it. Any sense of what ambition means in this case when women have often had to take on the burden of increased family responsibility?
You know, and ambition is a funny word, John. It could mean a lot of different things, but it might indicate if you're less ambitious, it might mean that you're not going to put yourself up for a promotion, or you may not ask for a raise, or you may not see yourself as being able to climb the corporate ladder. So it could have various different implications. But I think that if you look at all the data about why women feel burned out, and we do have more of that in our survey, some of that for, say, working moms is about feeling like they can't juggle the work-life balance. So we'll see what changes for these results, because we will revisit this in the future, but we'll see what changes as more women go back to work, as schools reopen. But for now, there are a lot of factors indicating that GDP could be really depressed if women are pulling themselves out of the workforce.
Right. One of the most important factors for the ongoing growth, we hope, of the economy. Julia, thanks. That's going to do it for The Exchange.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.